Welcome to the Exec MBA Podcast. I'm Brett Twitty, Director of Admissions for the Executive Formats of the Darden MBA, and you are listening to a new episode. So in this episode, I'd like to feature a conversation I recently recorded with David Tuvey. David is Senior Director of the iLab here at UVA, and he and I recently sat down to talk a little bit more about entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial resources at Darden and the University of Virginia. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that entrepreneurship is one of our favorite topics, and we've featured a number of episodes and interviews on entrepreneurship over the past year. And if you're new to the podcast, highly recommend checking out those episodes as well. They're not to be missed. But without further ado, here's my conversation with David Tuvey. David, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
So for our listeners at home, tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you do.
Oh, I like to keep what I do top secret. That makes it a lot easier, particularly during the annual reviews, because there's really no way to know what to measure.
That's right.
I think someone who has my job does a range of things, everything from constructing and sending out mass emails to alumni of the programs or other programs, just meeting and counseling people, helping them with whatever ideas they're working on. Helping to orchestrate competitions across grounds, traveling to events in different cities, answering emails. So many emails.
many different hats.
Yeah, so there's no – because once you're not in faculty mode, there's no normal cadence. So our cadence now at the iLab is months and years as opposed to maybe a semester or a quarter.
Right. So for folks who are less familiar with the iLab, obviously we've talked a lot on the podcast here about entrepreneurship, but some folks listening may not know too much about the iLab. What is the iLab?
Okay. I think it's easier to think of the iLab as a space or a place, group of people, set of programs and other resources to support entrepreneurs and then just innovators in general. The place right now is around 9,500 square feet on Nash Drive. A mix of classroom space, workspace, makerspace, big lobby with a soon-to-return coffee shop, and then other small meeting rooms. The people, myself, Jason Brewster, who directs the incubator program and other things, Sandra McCutcheon, who supports the various programs and other programming, and then the network of mentors and/or advisors with whom we'll connect ourselves or connect any teams with whom we're working. And then the programs, which are those people know about and those that are new and those that I don't even know if we call them programs, but they happen every year. So the one most people know about is the Summer Incubator Program, which is now technically in its 18th year. I'm questioning whether it's in its 19th. I got to find out if there was one summer before 2000 when it actually happened. And this is a 12-week accelerator program that runs during the summer. We also have new programs now, one specifically for Darden students. I call it, I'm a student and oh my God, I have a startup. So it's not for students that are working on ideas, but they're actually managing an early stage company while being a student. That's called Venture Lab. We'll have a new program that's just kerneling out now called Catalyst, which is as much Charlottesville facing as it is university facing, or maybe even more so Charlottesville facing, in that it's just supporting early stage companies in the area, that are sort of in the gap between initial product development and customers and funding of some kind or growth. Then we also have a more ad hoc, we'll say, range of innovation or support programming. And that could be anything from an upcoming workshop on 3D printing and CAD to workshops on how to pitch. I know I have one on Thursday night that's more sort of market analysis for people that don't have MBAs. Actually, could keep going. Like on this Friday, we'll have 10 entrepreneurs from Latin America here. They're here every Friday for the next month as part of a program run out of the presidential precinct in partnership with this tiny organization called the State Department. And then I guess the general other resources that we have. So for the teams that we're supporting, we'll go out and try to get similar resources that other accelerator programs might have, whether it's Amazon Web Services, Google Cloud, HubSpot, SendGrid, et cetera, to just basically buy them time and other resources on the cheap so they can, I guess, survive longer and see if people really want whatever it is they're making.
Yeah. So you did a lot of different things before coming here to UVA. I mean, so talk a little bit about your career progression before you ended up here on ground.
Okay. So I started as a market maker in currency and index options on a major exchange in Chicago. Did that for almost 10 years. Actually, in theory, that's where I started my first company because I was helped start a small trading group. Over that decade, physical trading was dying out. We weren't dying. We were fine. But it was definitely going both online and to the over-the-counter environments. Plus, I guess I was just getting bored. I think some people like to do that repeatedly. And for me, market making is a different species from what people think of when they think of trading. So it's more like, this isn't the right way to say it, but it's probably the right way to say it. It's more like being in the casino. You're buying and selling. You're sort of making both sides of the market. You're not trying to predict up or down. You're adjusting other variables depending upon whether we're going up or down. Then started an early music service in the late 90s, an attempt to essentially, back then it was fill a server with music and ask people to pay to have access to and stream that music. It was extremely early in the world of online music services. That became part of a company called Sonic that made a media player. Now people really most people probably don't even listen to music on their computer. It's probably almost in all cases on their mobile phone or mobile devices, which are computers, but they don't necessarily have a player on their desktop. These were software players on desktop. That one was probably one of the most downloaded apps during that 2 or 3 year period. It was acquired by a large search company. Then started to work on let's let people upload videos site. That was too early. It was taken out in the backyard. A hole was dug and it was put to rest. That's like year 2000 stuff. So this is pretty early in the sequence. People had big digital video cameras, not mobile phones, and taking video from them and plugging it into your computer and slurping all the video and then collapsing it, compressing it, and then somehow uploading it over that internet connection that's not that fast, not that quick. Then worked with another media company that was essentially building a platform for personalization. That kind of went sideways. This was around the 2001, 2002 era. Mm. It was acquired by a media company called Sony, which is now, in comparison to what it was, decades ago, much smaller in terms of the devices, I think mobile devices. Then sort of transitioned, traveled a bit. And then started more on the work in a university path, so master's and then a PhD. While doing the PhD, suddenly all that stuff we were doing 7 years earlier around music became interesting. So a number of copyright organizations, large and small, would sort of get in contact. So I did various projects actually while finishing a PhD around licensing new or different uses of music or pricing new and different uses of music. And then started teaching at Washington and Lee, then at UVA. Mm-hmm. And then I don't really call what I do teaching now because I'm not teaching classes, but then at the iLab here at Dart.
Yeah. So I guess now we all think about just you listen to music digitally, right? This is a given now. And Spotify, saw the other day, have close to 160 million users, something like that. I mean,
yeah, in the music world, these numbers seem big, but when you compare it to actually how many people listen to music, it's still an early scene. Mm. I think what most people don't realize, if they're not old and gray like some of us, is we had these services we tried one in 98. Mm. They started to really appear in 2000, 2001, and 2. And they functioned almost identically the way they function now. You pick a song, press play, and off you go. But it was just too early in terms of human behavior. Regardless of we'll call it a file sharing wave, which is probably the same as it was before. It's just there's so many other humans online. It just didn't really catch on until probably a decade after. Even when Spotify launched in Sweden, in the Nordic regions first, there were other streaming services just like it on the planet. Mm-hmm. None of them, maybe only one of them, or a very tiny number, actually had a free version. So that's sort of what helped it grow.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, launching where it did, in the part of the world where it did, it was probably maybe one of the few parts of the world that was willing to construct that sort of a deal early on. But we're going down the rabbit hole of musical copyright. We don't want to go down
that.
That's
all right. Well, your point about timing, particularly with sort of tech startups, and is well taken. You think about any of the ride sharing apps, you know, the sort of socialization of that, the aspect of getting in a stranger's car or Airbnb, staying in a stranger's house. You know, you don't know these people, yet you're in their probably most intimate spaces in, the, in their lives. It's kind of, unless they own a rental property that they happen to list, but that's a little bit different. But it's timing is a lot of it.
Yeah, these are not there's certain aspects, we'll say, of Lyft or Uber that are definitely high tech plays, but it is as much social, right? People's comfort level, or they're not thinking about it. They're just willing to engage in it and don't think too hard. Because if I think too hard, I'll go to the hotel.
So you've obviously had a lot of entrepreneurial experience. I mean, what's most exciting to you about, you know, sort of being involved in sort of startups or around sort of startup culture and the work that you're doing now?
There's a guy, Steve Blank, infamous in the world of startups, who may or may not have, but often uses a phrase, a startup is not a little business. So I think what's interesting to working with startups, or even just people working through ideas, is the earliest moments when there's a lot of uncertainty, but not a lot of risk. And that may seem weird, but there's no downside. If they're wrong, no one's going to get hurt in most cases, unless it's a medical device. But they're really trying to figure out what works and what doesn't, which really is sort of almost like running little social experiments. Like, how does the world work? And does it want the bread that I'm making? Right. So it's really this experiment in what the world wants, needs, or otherwise doesn't even understand quite yet. And those moments are really interesting, right? And they are different. They're usually different. You start to see patterns among companies we work with, but they're more industry related. Each company ends up being unique. And then any student idea ends up being usually unique. And when they're not unique, we try to politely let them know otherwise, right?
Yeah.
But also the behaviors in which you engage as a founder are just, they're unnatural, but they're natural, I think. So also just encouraging people to do that, to kind of do, I won't say the opposite of what you're taught, but something maybe slightly less planned out than you might have otherwise thought, or maybe actually planned completely differently. So like, no, don't survey all your friends, because they won't know the answer to these questions and they can't give you a good response. Let's build a version of what you're doing. Or challenging people, particularly I'll say in business schools or higher grade undergraduate communities who are sort of used to having to be right all the time and have it all well packaged, to build and do something that may be a little sloppy and be proud of it and get feedback on it and then adjust it over time. And in fact, I would say that's probably one of the more discrete or noticeable barriers we see from people, is just an unwillingness to build not even the beta, or not even the alpha, but the duct tape together thing that lets you actually in person interact with people who might consume or otherwise enjoy what you're doing. So you get real feedback.
We had a conversation with Melissa Stefaniak, who was in the iLab this summer, executive MBA student. She was talking about that very thing, about how tendency as a person with an idea is to try to focus on trying to make it perfect, perfect, perfect by yourself, right, before you ever put it out to the world. But she was encouraged, you know, with her single bake sweets idea, just to get it out there to the people, let them help you figure out what you need.
Yeah, and even then, I mean, if we think of, say, the Summer Incubator in particular as a program, when you step back from that as a process, you realize that even that program isn't necessarily uniquely or exclusively about the startups. It's about the people and them picking up a set of tools or tricks or techniques that they can adopt and use in a wide range of scenarios, regardless of whether whatever venture they're working on at the moment is the venture. Because these are things you apply in almost all circumstances. And I think what splinters or starts to fragment away for people eventually is you do these same things at big companies. They call you intrapreneur or they call you something else in that context. But they're not weird or unique to, quote, small companies. And that's why I think it's a fit that it's a startup is not a small business. Mm-hmm. It's this like – it's more like a infant, right? And you're trying to figure out if and how it can survive in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit different from, oh, we just make $100 rather than $100,000. Those are just business questions. Like, I can still do that math in any circumstance. It's just one of those misses a few zeros as compared to the other.
Thinking about that summer class, how do you feel like the entrepreneurs shape each other, right? Because they're all around. They're in the iLab, mm-hmm. right? They have to be there a certain number of hours. How does that ecosystem function?
So have to be there a certain number of hours is different from they should be there. There's no punch clock, but we may want to think about that actually. I think, they're a support group. Not all of them make it through the summer. They all survive, but the venture might not survive. So they're a support group as they go through the highs and the lows. They're sharing ideas with each other. So kind of getting feedback internally. It's like having your own focus group every day who's willing to try your product, even if it's made with crickets, as was the case this summer. Those are probably the two biggest dimensions to sort of the summer cohortiness, like the fact that they're all together. There's going to be different backgrounds as well. So they are able to learn other things from each other. There may be someone who worked, I mean, most of them don't make any money yet. So having someone that works in finance doesn't necessarily help you quite yet, but they may have someone working on a similar or different food product, but they've dealt with similar issues around packaging, labeling mm-hmm. on packaging for food. One group goes through it and then information on how to navigate it spreads. Mm-hmm. There's usually if someone's working on a software or a webware or some other technical product, there's probably somebody else in the cohort that can help. We haven't seen as much, re-teaming as might be expected, where teams are like, this doesn't work, but we really like what you're doing. And they sort of mm-hmm. form a new team. But I'm never surprised if that happens.
What role do alumni play in sort of supporting entrepreneurship and innovation here?
So their connections into industries or other companies and markets. So they're an alumni that's a founder. So they're a role model for other students that are thinking about becoming founders. This is why we specifically bring back almost exclusively alumni founders because they seem like there's a more direct connection between the two. They're advisors or mentors, depending about how you define the word for the teams or the people that we're working with. So either helping them understand industry issues or just navigate things as a founder of an early stage company. Their connections to capital or other sorts of resources you might need, regardless of, say, industry knowledge. I think those are the three big bins into which alumni engagement triggers. Sometimes their names on the building. That's another way in which they engage. I think in all those cases, even when their name is on the building, they almost put the higher value on their time and their commitment to the people that are in the programs. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Mr. Lyons Brown is also a mentor in the program, and he'll meet with specific teams when he's in town.
Yeah, he gave a tremendous talk to some of our prospective students.
Oh, great.
During Darden Days, and it's just, I mean, his level of energy and passion for entrepreneurs. He's still starting businesses, still doing things, very much active in that space. So, and then Charlottesville. People do talk about the startup community here. I imagine that you have a front row seat and very much involved in a lot of that. For those listeners who are less familiar with Charlottesville or just learning about what all goes on here, how would you describe sort of the entrepreneurial scene here in Charlottesville?
So I would say it's not massive, but it's concentrated, very engaging, and probably there's more happening here than people think. And at a level that's higher than I think people anticipate. So there are data science-based early-stage companies here that are as interesting as they would be in any other city. There's new and different medical devices. There's a low-power microprocessor developed here. It's manufactured elsewhere, but it's all designed and built here. You actually have the full portfolio usually of sort of the startup industries. The startups in the energy world are a little bit different, but we've had multiple clean tech or solar and wind power startups in town. So I think people that aren't in Charlottesville don't recognize that there actually is a portfolio of startups in the town. And it's not they're not invisible. They have connections outside Charlottesville. And it's a sort of a – it's a helpful environment if you're a student looking to work in the startup scene because we likely know so much of the portfolio because we've interacted with them personally. So we're able to make connections pretty directly. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have an available – a space we share with others actually downtown to help make these connections more easily, just to be sort of part of the downtown scene. Yeah. Charlottesville's not huge, but there actually is no direct pathway from North Crowns to downtown. It's all around a bunch of other things. So I'll spend one or two days or parts of a few days a week not on Crowns. Mm-hmm.
So what would you want prospective students to know about the entrepreneurial resources that are available? Say, I'm sitting at home, I've got a strong interest in entrepreneurship, or I have a business idea that I'm coming to business school to potentially pursue. What would you want that student to know?
I would say from the Darden side, just know that I believe, as far as I could tell, the full portfolio of support you might need is here. And has actually been around for quite some time. So Darden moved pretty early after the Batten Gift to develop, courses, programs, other sorts of programming, resources, scholarships, internships, all these sorts of support that plug you into the entrepreneurial or just innovation environment. Other schools are now sort of becoming what everybody does, but it really is something that's happened here for some time, such that they kind of know what they're doing. Like if you come in and you don't know if you have a startup idea, but you're interested in working in a startup, we're like, oh, BVIP, right? And this is not what I do on a day-to-day basis at the iLab, but because we're so aware of it, just about anybody at the Batten Institute can probably tell you all the things that are available to you as a resource. So the full, package from classes to competitions to just general workshops to the student organizations and what they do, physical space, other resources, they're sort of all here. Mm-hmm. What we don't have is the person that will write that app for you. So I'm sorry, but it's probably the case that you should be able to do it or find mm-hmm. a partner who will do it with you. Mm-hmm. And then because we're at a university and not just a business school off on its own, then all those other resources become available to you, the other students and faculty and staff across grounds to create even a wider range of connections. So, for example, we have an aging MakerBot in the iLab building. We may not need to upgrade it right away because there's millions of dollars of worth of equipment half a mile away. So we'll just deliver you there. And that's a whole range of different 3D printing, prototyping, and other sorts of equipment. So you can sort of leverage the resources of the full university above and beyond the resources that are here.
It's been fun for those of us affiliated with the Executive MBA program to have a few students be in the incubator program. And Melissa is the most recent example mm-hmm. of that. So one of the things that those students have stressed, and I think you talked about this a little bit earlier, is that entrepreneurship, yes, it's a thing, right? It's something that you do, but it's also more of a mentality, like it's a perspective, a way that you think about problems or approaching mm-hmm. problems. And there's lots of different ways you can pursue this interest, right? The iLab incubator program is one, but the competitions are potentially another example. And you mentioned earlier that you were involved with the competitions here mm-hmm. at the University of Virginia. So talk a little bit more about the ways that students can take their idea and potentially compete.
So let's just be clear, executive mm-hmm. MBA students are students at the University of Virginia. Mm-hmm. So they're yeah. open. All the competitions are open to them. And in fact, the big competition sequence, the Entrepreneurship Cup or E-Cup, mm-hmm. Is even open to postdocs above and beyond the student population. Little aside, it may be helpful for folks to know that of all the stages of our present competition, I believe they actually were all born out of Darden or the Batten Institute, meaning it was first a competition here and then it was spread across grounds. Mm-hmm. The way it's structured now at the university is intended to sort of help people from idea to sort of start something. And that was a lot of sort ofs, because at that mm-hmm. stage, there's probably more sort ofs than you'd think. Mm-hmm. The first stage is the concept competition, which is really honestly that. It's about ideas. Mm-hmm. Many years ago, there were large prize money at this stage, and that was changed a few years ago. So on grounds and including UVA-wise, 25 teams win $1,000 each. And it's just about surfacing mm-hmm. ideas. There's five tracks in total, one of which is WISE. The other four around technology or health, consumer and B2B, and then social ventures or social entrepreneurship. It's a way to connect with other students who are working on ideas at that point, because the final night in all the tracks will have at least 10 teams. So you've got 40 teams on grounds who are all pursuing something, ready to meet and compete with each other. And then it transitions to the second stage, which is simply called discovery. In its previous incarnation, it was called the Effectual De-Risking Competition. That was a little more complicated to say. So the discovery stage is really about customer discovery. It's built upon the framework of effectuation. So all the pitches and responses from the teams are sort of built upon that language. But it's ultimately guided or geared towards getting you to talk to and interact with actual humans and get feedback mm-hmm. on what you're doing and try to get traction. Not like in the hospital traction, but evidence mm-hmm. that someone really wants what you're doing and that there's demand. And then that stage, there's five winners. Each get $5,000. And notice, because both of those stages are still pretty early, there's no first place, second, and third. It's really difficult for any judge in those circumstances to tell the difference. So they just sort of pick the top five in the discovery. The last stage is now called launch. That looks more like a traditional business plan competition, except you have to be an incorporated entity to receive the prize money. So it ends up sort of self-filtering to those teams that are actually working on startups. And it was an immediate shift for us at the university. So in years prior to that shift, both in terms of the sequencing of the competition and the sort of added twist, maybe one of the teams in the finals for what was then called the E-Cup, which really looked like the concept competition, mm-hmm. Would become an actual company. Now, the finalists that are pitching, the great majority of them are already ventures that students are working on. And then I'm trying to think, this last year, this one's a little bit of a hazy because it was spring. Spring always gets really busy for us. Multiple of them had either participated in the summer incubator program or were headed toward it. And I think one of the winners is not necessarily a venture anymore, but the other two are. And then there were probably three or four others in that mix that are still students actively working on their companies.
That's great. I am just learning. I'm learning more about the competitions, and I'd always known about sort of the first phase mm-hmm. of it. And the other two were less familiar to me.
So 3 or 4 years ago, right in there, the E-Cup was really just the concept competition. Mm-hmm. The second stage was, as we noted, the effectual de-risking. and the third stage was the Darden business plan competition. Mm-hmm. So in one summer moment between school years, the various faculty and staff across the university who helped manage the competition and help it happen just revamped it. So there are multiple, there's other schools, MIT in particular, I forget, there may be a couple others that have this staged approach mm-hmm. to competitions. And it seems to work better, mm-hmm. both from the point of view of helping students sort of come out with their ideas early on, low risk, high uncertainty, and sort of a levelish playing field, because the way the concept competition is constructed, you won't necessarily going to be better at it because you've been working on this for a while, per se. It's really about impact and ideas. The final stage, however, there's a clear advantage mm-hmm. to have actually been working on this mm-hmm. And to be able to answer a lot of the questions that a solid pitch would be mm-hmm. able to answer.
And we've been doing an ongoing series on entrepreneurship. We've had a growing number of students who are interested in entrepreneurship, and students are always asking about what resources or what they have access to as executive format students here at Darden. So what are some of the things that you would highlight for our executive format students?
Okay. So I think most people, when they're thinking about the resources at Darden in particular, for any of the students, they sort of maybe overemphasize the place and the programs and underemphasize the people. So the fact that we're just sort of here and available. For exec MBA students, I feel like their situation is unique in that the great majority are working full time while also studying full time. So I would first gander a warning that it can be really difficult to work full time, do school full time, and do that startup because you're going to run out of full times, right? However, it then ends up being a really useful period of time when you have any extra moments to begin testing ideas as opposed to thinking you're actually going to start while you're in student mode and in full-time work mode. I think people in the program maybe should feel a little more willing than they might otherwise be to just reach out to us and ask for some thoughts, feedback, or recommendations on how to do what they're doing. Doing any sort of more specific programming for exec MBA students can be challenging because their lives are already super busy. So it's totally understood that it may be more ad hoc or one at a time. And then I guess don't underestimate the value of like having a job and understanding an industry, because oftentimes the more compelling opportunities may actually emerge from your own experience or experience of your friends, as opposed to that wacky idea you have that's very unrelated to whatever it is you're already doing. I'm a weird example of this. I had nothing to do with music and then tried to do something in music. It was really hard. I basically had to like hang out with lawyers all the time to just try to understand what was going on, because the technology was sort of uncertain, but not really. The only thing that was uncertain was paying for digital goods in a subscription form. Like the market for selling digital things hadn't really established itself. Even credit card companies were like, wait, you don't ship anybody anything? You just sort of like let them hear, wait, what? So it was different. So there's a lot of learning then that happens. And frankly, had I known more about the industry, I probably wouldn't have started yet. It was more fun to just start something to see if it was possible. It wasn't, but it was fun to learn. It was technically possible, but not humanly interesting for like a while. So for the exec MBA students, just recognize that your industry experience may actually be more valuable than you think. The pivot to something totally different can actually be hard. But regardless, don't think that you're not supposed to reach out to us or not open to reaching out to us until you already have that big idea and you've already been working on it. Feel free to drop a line. I'm just david@virginia.edu. And we'll try to connect you with whoever we can if it's not one of us.
Yeah, we stress that with students all the time because, you know, oftentimes they think, gosh, I don't live in Charlottesville. You know, I'm working, I'm doing all this. Can I still access, you know, faculty? Can I still reach out to people? And that is why you come to Darden, right? It's a community.
Yeah, I mean, MJ Toms is another person on the staff. Jason Brewster, you can email us. And in fact, just bear in mind, oftentimes the faculty are willing to help, but they're doing a lot of other stuff too. So essentially, we're hired to not do all that other stuff and try to work more directly with students who have interests in just innovation technology and specifically entrepreneurship.
Yeah, MJ has been great. She's also been on the podcast to talk about resources for students.
I'm sure I was much better on the podcast than MJ was. No? Okay.
No, fantastic job. And like I said, I think for a lot of students, just knowing that the resources are available and that you can build those relationships, because, you know, to your earlier point, it's all about sort of talking and connecting and sort of investigating something that you might be thinking about.
Yeah, and while you're doing school, it's more challenging for the exec MBA folks simply because of the shortage of time. But it is an interesting moment to just test stuff. The risk level from your opportunity cost is pretty low. You have a job. You are in school. You will be educated by the end, right? So now little projects on the side, we'll try to help make the most of a project so that the end of it is maybe learning whether you should pursue this or not, right? Having enough feedback to reckon that there might be something there before people sort of maybe expend too much on the project, commit too much to it, and then find out farther down the line that it didn't really work. It's almost like we're successful if people fail faster, save time and money, and learn that that great idea might not be that great right now, but that's okay. And it's a totally acceptable outcome. And it's a more acceptable outcome probably while you're studenting than when you're not.
And that was my conversation with David Tuvey, Senior Director of the iLab here at UVA. Of course, if you have comments, suggestions, requests, anything you'd like for us to cover here on the podcast, we're all ears. We can be reached at exec, that's E-X-E-C, MBA at darden.virginia.edu. And until next time, thanks for listening.